Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The most heartening thing about this progress is that the ways that black and Hispanic students are leading the way. The proportion of black students scoring at levels 3 and 4 in math has increased by 29 percentage points, and that Hispanic student performance is up 29.6 points.
Mayor Bloomberg, in our breakfast interview yesterday, trumpeting the success of his education reforms on the last day of school, math scores were the biggest success story this year, going up 8 points on average in grades 3 through 8, but reading scores were flat, and about half the kids still read at grade level. More big changes are in store for the schools beginning in September, including even more standardized testing. And with us now to talk about the last school year and the next one is New York City Schools Chancellor Joel Klein. Chancellor Klein, we always appreciate you coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Great to be with you today, Brian.
First, what do you think this year's test scores mean, both in math and in reading?
I think they mean good news for the city. The math, as you said, is unequivocal good news. To go up across 6 grades, 8 points, outperform the state. And indeed, when it happened, for the first time, the media said, you can't compare New York City to other large cities in New York State. You can now start to compare them to some of our suburban school districts. That's really a paradigm shift, Brian, and I think reflects an enormous amount of good work by our teachers, principals, and so on. On the reading scores, I think there's a little bit of confusion. You rightly said they were flat. However, this year, for the first time, they tested all English language learners after their first year. In the past, they had never done that. So it wasn't
English language learners, meaning immigrants who come here without English as their first language.
Exactly, and who don't speak English, not even a question of first language. And so after 1 year, the number who got tested this year went up by more than double. And so the state commissioner actually pointed out that our reading scores would have gone up across those grades about 2.5 points if it was an apples-to-apples comparison. But fair to say that we have more work to do in reading. We've had great success in math. Our graduation rate is up significantly. In the last 2 years, by the state's calculation, we went up 6 points. The rest of the state went down 2. And our 5-year graduation rate, we went up 10 points. So I think this is a good news story. The hardest thing is to say we've made a lot of progress, but we have much more that we need to do.
On the math scores, the Daily News today says the federal government considers our math tests the 5th easiest of all the states in the country. The reading tests are harder. So could the math scores be an illusion of progress created by easy tests?
No, actually, it's two things. First of all, the math test that they referred to was from several years ago. It was the 4th grade when we had only 4th and 8th. And at that point, the 8th grade test, I think, was the 13th hardest. Since then, the commissioner has changed the math test, and that's been clear. So I think it isn't an illusion. And the other thing is very powerful. At every grade, we outperform the rest of the state. So it's not just how much you go up. It's a question of whether you're moving up more quickly. So I think this is hardly an illusion.
By outperform, you mean increasing faster?
Much faster, yes.
And on the reading scores, and I understand what you say about the English language learners, but it still might represent a relatively slow rate of improvement. Was the balanced literacy program, as you call it, successful? The schools are also using a program called Wilson for all struggling readers, including special ed. Is this not helping enough?
I think it's helping. I think that, you know, when you say you sort of one of these things where the math scores have gone up 30 points, the English scores have gone up about 12 to 15 points during a similar time frame.
What do the points mean? What do you mean by points?
In other words, when we started, the level of students who were on grade was about 30% in each in math and English, grades 3 to 8. The math scores, as you point out, basically more than doubled. The English scores have gone up about 15 points during the same period, but
percentage of students reading at grade level.
Exactly. 15 points over 5 years, 3 points a year, is a good success rate. I would like to see it grow more quickly, but it's kind of a little funny to say, well, the math scores went up so much that the 15 points in English, 15 points is a lot of students.
The system is preparing for another big shakeup in September, and I've been hearing from some parents and teachers and principals who are confused. As I understand it, really reduced to a nutshell, you're eliminating the 10 educational regions you created when Mayor Bloomberg took control. Now the principals can join one of six different support structures, and there's a new management structure with groups of 20 or so schools reporting to one individual, but the principals are also reporting to their local community superintendents who are in charge of rating them. So help me sort out what this means. Help parents and teachers and principals listening sort out why this what this means and why it matters to the kids.
Sure, be glad to. What it means is two key things, both of which matter directly to our students. The first thing it means is we were able to save almost $200 million from the bureaucracy, put it in the schools. As a result of that, you will see more teachers hired, more guidance counselors, extended time programs. Everybody understands the value of all of those things, and believe me, taking money from the bureaucracy and putting it into the schools is always going to help the kids and their education. You can't do that if you don't go through a reorganization, so that's why we did it. Second thing that happened is, I believe because of the progress, Brian, that we can differentiate the kind of support a school needs. The formal official who rates the school, who rates the principal, that's the community superintendent. It's always been that way under New York law. However, in the past, the regions used to provide all the school-based support. And what we did is said, instead of assigning a region, we would let the schools determine, and the process came off like a gem. The parents who were involved in the school leadership teams, they all met. We had forums and open houses throughout the city, and the excitement was literally palpable. And now you see different schools working as a school community have come up with different solutions, and that seems to me to be a way to move the system forward in a very good and effective way.
We have a first of three expected Supreme Court rulings coming down this hour. The Supreme Court has blocked the execution of a mentally ill Texas murderer. At issue was how mentally ill someone had to be in order to be deemed outside of the constitutional permissibility to execute that person. And in this particular case, they deemed this person to be too mentally ill. We are expecting a major education and desegregation in education ruling any minute, which we will ask Chancellor Klein about when it comes down, because it may have ramifications for New York, but we're still waiting for that. Back to the reorganization of the schools. When the mayor got control, 5 years ago now, you de-emphasized the old 32 school districts and created the 10 regions instead. Now the regions are out already in favor of all this other stuff. Did the first reorganization not work as you had hoped?
The first reorganization worked precisely as we had hoped. Indeed, the scores you were talking about are the proof of it. I mean, we got the results. Graduation rates went up. Our test scores consistently went up.
But you didn't say at that time, well, we're going to put these regions in this kind of organizational structure, and then in a few years we're going to dismantle them, did you?
Actually, what I did say, I made a speech at NYU about a year and a half into the first set of reorganization, and I explained then that the reason we moved to a regional structure was to depoliticize the school system and to focus on instruction, that it was intended to be top-down, but that over time what I wanted to do is shift the emphasis to a school-based model and that we would evolve. And all of that I laid out, as I say, in a speech at NYU. So it's an evolution. You know, people like to say, it's funny, in the world that I inhabited, there's always a dynamism about an organization. You grow to meet new and different challenges, and it's a little bit analogous to the way you raise a child. At different points in a child's life, you give a child greater autonomy and authority over his or her decision-making. This is the same thing in an organizational system. And we started with a highly organized, if you will, not decentralized system, because we really needed to bring coherence. We needed to bring order. I think we've accomplished that, Brian. Now I think what we can do is bring dynamism into the organizational structure.
And what does this mean for parents? Because in the old days, parents could go to their district office if they were unhappy about something in their schools. Where do they turn now? Can they go to the superintendent or to whoever's in charge of their particular network of schools, or who?
They would go to the superintendent. In each district, we will have parent support officers. We brought in a new person, Martine Guerrier, who the mayor appointed as the chief family support officer, and she is going to be monitoring all of that. In fact, I think one of the good things about this change that parents will recognize is there'll be more support closer to the schools rather than in what used to be the regions, and that'll give them, if you will, greater access. And I think we need to continue to work on ways to make sure parents are heard, parents are engaged effectively. I think there's room for improvement in that area.
A lot of parents do think there's room for improvement in that area. Put on your headphones because I'm going to play you another clip of the mayor from our breakfast event yesterday. Listen to what he said here, especially the end part about parents.
Before, we had this elected group where it was just a patronage thing, where people were using it as a stepping stone, and certainly we're not doing the job that a professional parent coordinator are doing today. Teachers should run the classroom with direction from the principals, not parents.
Teachers should run the classroom with direction from the principals, not parents. What do you think about that quote, and especially in light of all the complaints that you've had this year, which I think you would acknowledge, from parents' groups who accuse you of alienating them and moving too fast to reorganize without their input?
Actually, we had some complaints. I think we've worked those through. You probably recall when we had the event with the various parents' groups, and we've got committees that are working on it. I think in the end, the mayor's right, Brian. I think in the end, I mean, let's be candid. I think in the end, schools need to be responsible and accountable for the education. That doesn't mean parents shouldn't be heard. That's why we put a parent coordinator in every school. But in the end, it seems to me that the delivery of educational services is a responsibility of the principal, assistant principals, and teachers in the schools. And we can't have, for example, if parents groups say one group wants this curriculum, another group wants another curriculum, I don't think you can run a school system effectively that way.
It didn't sound to you in that clip like the mayor was disinviting parents from having input on their schools?
I don't think so at all. I think the mayor started by saying, we put in a $70 million initiative on parent coordinators. That was not to disinvite, that was to invite and to open up. But in the end, the question really is, if you're trying to decide certain key decisions, who's responsible? And I think the mayor was rightly saying that the principal, the teachers have to be responsible for making the core educational decisions. Decisions about the school, the way the school runs, the finances, all of those things are reviewed through the senior school leadership team, and parents participate in that as well.
Here is that latest Supreme Court ruling now on race and public education. The Supreme Court has limited the use of race when assigning students to the public schools. Now, Chancellor Klein, you used to be a lawyer who practiced in federal court. Tell us about this case as you understand it and what it means for the school districts involved, which are in other states, and if you think it has implications for New York.
Well, I haven't read the opinion. I did spend a good part of my career as a constitutional lawyer. I suspect what the court says is that there are very limited circumstances in which you can make assignments based on race. A lot of school districts, not New York, a lot of school districts had plans where they would try to, in various schools, say you'd have 50% of one race, 50% of another, that kind of thing. And those were the issues were called into question in the Supreme Court case.
In this case, we should say it's not a segregation case like Brown versus Board of Education. It's a desegregation case where they were trying to keep a certain percentage of various groups in the schools for the purpose of desegregation. But the court said in one case in Kentucky, one case in Washington State, that they went too far.
Right. And again, I suspect what they try to do is, in these cases, in various districts as part of desegregation, create a racial balance in the school, and so they have different admissions criteria. We have, I think, only two schools in the entire city, both under various court orders. And after we review this case, we're going to decide what action is appropriate. I think in New York City, to be quite frank, I think the focus has been correctly on improving education in every neighborhood, for every school with every racial mix. Almost three-quarters of our students are African-American and Latino. In an environment like that, a focus on racial balance seems to me to be not the way to solve the problems. A focus on high-quality education for every kid in every school, I think, is the way.
There is one Brooklyn school that's been in the news recently, IS-239, the Mark Twain School in Coney Island, that has a quota of 60% white and 40% non-white, even though the population there is only about 30% white. What's that situation?
Well, that's a situation, actually, I said the other day, I think that's an anachronistic court order. It's probably 30 years old. And we were waiting for this decision, assuming what specifically is in the decision. Brian will decide what motions to file in court. But again, it seems to me that we should focus on quality education for all students in every community. And something like Mark Twain is, I think, a product of a different era.
Well, Mark Twain, just to drill down on that a little bit, I guess being a product of a different era, at the time when they said 60% white and 40% students of color, that was at a time when probably most of the district was white. So it was a way to admit students of color and integrate the schools, right? In this particular magnet
in
school.
In that particular magnet, correct.
Now the local white population has dropped so far that this 60% white requirement actually makes it very unrepresentatively white, which presents this incredible advantage for white students beyond their percentage in the local population, certainly beyond their percentage in the school system as a whole for this particular school, right?
Correct. But it certainly, I've said that I think it makes no sense. But I think the whole approach is one that is anachronistic. And again, depending on precisely what the court ruled today, will take appropriate action.
Just on that one, why would you even need the court decision to give you guidance on what to do? You could dismantle that old quota system to the advantage of students of color anyway, couldn't you?
You can't, no, because it's a court order. That case resulted from
a federal court order.
So we decided to see before the lawyers filed any motions for further relief what the Supreme Court said. That's why we waited until now.
Okay, we'll continue in a minute with New York City Schools Chancellor Joel Klein. When we continue, we'll talk about more of the reorganization plan for next year, including more standardized testing and what some parents are saying about that. Stay with us.
I think all of that preparation for the test, given you don't know the answers, is exactly what you need. Think about it. Every one of you in this room, when you had to study for the test, you had to learn how to add because you couldn't get through the test unless you did. Adding is a useful skill to have.
Mayor Bloomberg, again, from our breakfast interview yesterday, supporting addition. Yes, it's a useful tool to have. Everybody will agree with that. I had told him that UFT President Randy Weingarten had complained to me that teachers now spend 20% of class time on test prep, diluting, she says, the richness of education for teaching, in exchange for teaching 2+2. And that was his response. Schools Chancellor Joel Klein is my guest on WNYC. I gather there will be more testing and more test prep next year. How much and why?
I think you're confusing two things. I think if by test prep you mean preparing people for the skills they need, math, reading, these are basic skills. You know, we can kid about it, but the truth of the matter is when I got here, there were thousands and thousands of kids in high school who couldn't do basic math and didn't know how to read. How did the school system let that happen? So if what we're talking about is teaching people the skills they need the basics as well as the higher order skills. One of the great fights in education, which I don't understand, Brian, is some people say, well, just teach the basics. Other people say, you got to focus on higher order skills like thinking and imagination and problem solving. I think you got to do both, but you certainly have got to master the basic skills. And what we're doing next year with a series of assessments, which will be very quick to administer and you'll get the results immediately, is to make sure that our students are learning the knowledge. You know, I find this discussion an interesting one only because I went to public schools for 13 years in New York City. And when I was in public schools in New York City, we were getting tested all the time. Tested on long division, tested on fractions, tested on science, tested on math, tested on reading skills. And the reason we were, there are two things that a test does. One, it gives the child a chance to consolidate her knowledge. And the second thing it does is it gives the teacher an opportunity to see what the child has mastered and what she hasn't. There's no purpose in trying to move forward if a child hasn't mastered antecedent skills.
So I guess the question now is, what's the balance? Randy Weingarten says 20% of teachers' time is spent in test prep, specifically for these reading and math standardized tests. She thinks that's too much for, you know, weighted in that direction and away from what you call the higher order skills. And put on your headphones again, because I want to play you a clip of a parent yesterday at PS 198 on the east side of Manhattan, where you went for the last day of school. Our education reporter Beth Fertig was there too, and brought back this soundbite that she says is representative of a lot of parents. This is Eva MacArthur, who says she has a pre-K daughter at PS 198 and a child who graduated from the lower lab school, and she loves her school, but
there's less teaching going on and more testing. And I think the kids, you know, feel the stress and the pressure of all this testing, because the teachers have to conform to these test results, you know, all the time. And yes, it's great, but, you know, they're, I think the testing is just too much testing.
So what do you say to Eva and parents like her? And let me throw in one more. A friend of mine whose kids go to a very good public elementary school is actually pulling them out for a private school because of this. And her main concern is that there won't be enough science because everything is geared to reading and math tests. So can you woo her back?
Sure. We actually are rolling out our science curriculum this year. I mean, I think it's part of our reforms. We started with reading and math because those are the basic building blocks. And then we're doing science this year and social studies next year. And what I would say about...
Does that mean there are going to be standardized tests on those too?
There will be tests on those, sure. And under NCLB, there'll be increasing tests, but we will
no
also...
No Child Left Behind, NCLB.
No Child Left Behind, correct. But let me answer. I think... that, again, maybe I just had a different experience. I do think there is a certain amount of pressure in getting an education. I think that's part, indeed, I think as people get older, the pressures in life increase on them. And I think we have an obligation to our students to teach them how to cope with pressure. I've talked, Brian, to hundreds and hundreds of students about standard. I said, what'd you think about it? Was it stressful? Some think it's more stressful than others. People react differently.
I don't hear them complaining about pressure, though. I hear them complaining about numbing, deadening test prep as opposed to rich educational interaction.
I think both have to go on. When people say numbing, deadening, you've got to learn basic math skills. If you don't, you're not going to do higher order problem solving. You've got to learn. For example, think about in a reading. There are about 14 key skills. What is a fact? What is an opinion, right? It's very important if I say that your show is a great show, people know that's my opinion, it's not a fact. Now, you might think it's a fact.
That's a fact.
That's what I figured, see? But these are skills kids need. If they don't have the skills, they won't do the work. So there's a discipline to education. It's not simply that you go into school and you emote. There's a real discipline, and kids have to learn that. That's a challenge for a lot of people. It does take doing homework. It does take being assessed and tested on those areas to make sure you mastered them. I don't think it's a good idea to say to kids, you don't need to do long division because we can give you a calculator. So, I think you need to do some work on that.
So they're already complaining about how much is test prep this year, and there's going to be more next year?
It's not more test prep. It's going to be assessments that it'll be done quickly, and you can get the results. So when I just said on fact versus opinion, if somebody doesn't know the difference between fact versus opinion, there's no purpose moving on to another block. We've got to make sure the child masters that skill. And these assessments will be administered quickly. There's no consequences for them. Nobody's being graded on them in the sense of, there'll be consequences pro or con. What there will be is information for teachers to know and understand. I've looked throughout the country. I've read the literature and the research. Those schools that are using this kind of information to drive success are doing much, much better. I was in a school a couple of weeks ago, Brian. It's an amazing school. It's an all-boys African-American Latino school in Bedford-Stuyvesant. It's called the Excellence Academy. This year, their first year of testing, in that school, 100% of the kids were proficient or better in math and 92% in English language arts. That's one of the most high-performing schools in the States. And that school uses data and information to make sure students master the skills they need to know. That's what we're trying to do here in New York.
Here's a little more on that Supreme Court decision on race and public schools that just came down this hour. They rejected public school assignment plans that take account of students' race. affecting Louisville, Kentucky, and Seattle in particular in these particular cases, but that could imperil similar plans in hundreds of districts nationwide, and it leaves public school systems with a limited arsenal to maintain racial diversity, says the AP. The court split 5-4, as with so many decisions this week, with Chief Justice John Roberts announcing the court's judgment. Justice Stephen Breyer wrote a dissent that was joined by the court's other three liberals. My guest on WNYC, New York City Schools Chancellor Joel Klein, who used to practice constitutional law in federal court. From those details, any more reaction with respect to what it means to the nation or to New York?
I think it'll have an impact in other cities. A lot of cities had desegregation plans that involved the kind of racial assignment patterns you talked about before. So you'd say you'd have 50% of one race, 50% of another, 60-40. In New York City, there are two schools in the entire city that are under a court order, and we'll look at this decision and decide what action. So, but in other cities, like Seattle, for example, it's a much more common practice.
Do you think, looking at the nation with your experience, that Brown versus Board of Education, the landmark desegregation decision, is in practice dead, even if it's not dead on paper?
I don't know. I'd say dead. You know, I knew Thurgood Marshall. I my wife served as a law clerk to Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall was one of my heroes. One of the best books I've ever read is a book called Simple Justice, and it details what Marshall did. Where I think we lost certain amount of direction was in thinking that through busing and moving kids around to create racial balance, we would get the results that we wanted. And in fact, what I think has changed, and I think changed for the better now, is we are focused on high-quality education in every school, in every community. And I think, if you will, Brown versus Board took a detour. Now I think its implementation is more effective.
Part of the reorganization, and by the way, listeners, we're going to take a closer look at that Supreme Court decision coming up in about a half hour with some other guests. But part of the reorganization that the mayor talked about yesterday for the New York City Public Schools next year is to have school funding set per capita, per student. Now, I understand the idea behind that. That's also a fairness thing, so that some schools won't get more money because of their connections than other schools. So it's funding per student, funding following the student. But will that create an incentive for principals to hire cheaper teachers, meaning less experienced teachers, because they'll have this flat amount of money to work with?
I don't think so, because every school's budget is increasing. What I do think it will create an incentive for is for principals to think intelligently about which people they hire and at what price. Let's be candid. Somebody who's a senior teacher and a very good teacher will command a top salary, and that'll be – people will want that person. Other people in the system who are younger, and so you're trying to decide, should I hire two who are younger or one who's more senior? Those are the real-world decisions that everybody makes.
But that means you're willing to allow principals to play around with class size, right? If they're going to hire two cheaper teachers or one more senior teacher, that means that class size will be variable.
That's always been the way it's been in the city. Class size varies throughout the city. We're doing two things, and I think they're both important. This is another one of these discussions. When you have two variables, you can always argue it round or flat. To me, the key two variables are, first and foremost, high-quality teacher. High-quality teacher in a class of 25 is better than a poor teacher in a class of 20. You would believe that. Every listener would believe that. If you can assure high quality, then you want to simultaneously lower class size. And we're doing that in the city. Next year, I have no doubt that our class sizes will go down. More teachers will be hired. By the same token, I'm very concerned, and the research shows that particularly in high-needs communities, they're not getting their equitable share of high-quality teachers. And we've got to focus on that as well. It's a key fairness issue. Teachers are the most important thing in a child's education. And if we're not fair and equitable in the distribution of teaching talent, we're really undermining Brown versus Board of Education.
Also on class size, you often say you want to reduce class sizes in the early grades. That's where the money has made a difference. But what about middle schools? The scores are still troubling in middle grades despite some improvements, and this is a big problem for all districts. And if they don't do well in middle school, they often drop out. So why not make classes really small for these kids?
I think we should, and we are working on it. But again, you've got to do it with quality. It's not just putting somebody in the school. Take the following example. Right now in New York, we don't have enough qualified math teachers. In some of my middle schools, people who are teaching math shouldn't be teaching math. That's why I want to be able to pay more to math teachers. If you lower the class size, for some kids, that's going to be great. But other kids who don't have a qualified math teacher could be hurt. But our agenda is to lower class size in middle schools, in high schools, and in elementary schools, simultaneously ensuring that we have high-quality teachers in all our classes.
One more thing before you go. On the disparity between ethnic groups and between rich and poor, you'll be paying parents to send kids to school and even paying some low-income kids who test really well under the mayor's anti-poverty plan. Is that patronizing?
No, I don't think it's patronizing. I think everybody sits and talks about poverty and education, right? I mean, for as long as you can remember, I can remember. And the truth of the matter is we haven't done remotely what we should do in making sure kids are educated and making sure that through education we eradicate poverty. That, to me, seems like a sensible program. What the mayor has done is try to raise private funds to see if different approaches work. We have some data and some analysis that shows the use of incentives in certain communities does lead kids to focus more on their education. You know, after all, what you're saying to a kid, one of the things you're saying to a kid is stay in school so you can get a great job and be successful. That's a long-term vision. Trying to motivate children in the short term sometimes presents challenges. This is an experiment. I think it's going to work. But in the end, if it doesn't, it's easy to phase out. And if it does, it's easy to increase.
Does it solve the endemic problems? Obviously, it doesn't solve all the endemic problems of poverty and parents who aren't educated well enough to help their children with homework. So is it just a Band-Aid until society can deal with poverty and inequity in society?
No, it seems to me it's not a Band-Aid. And also, I believe that the best way to deal with poverty is through ensuring a high-quality education for all students. And doing that over time, I think, will be the most effective way to combat poverty. We have a lot of other things to do right now about poverty. But I assure you, if you look at the data, high school graduates, as the mayor said, get twice as much in terms of their income, and college graduates four times as much. You're talking about the difference between having a standard of living that's above poverty and having a standard of living below poverty. The way to get us there is let's educate all our children. For far too long, we haven't done that. I think we're doing that in this city right now. Long way to go, but I think we're making progress.
All right. More changes to come in September in the New York City public schools. Chancellor Joel Klein, good luck. If you succeed, the city succeeds. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Brian.
New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn next. A major campaign finance law passed yesterday, but it treats unions differently from corporations. We'll find out what that means and if it's a good thing. Stay with us.